Okay, so we're now recording. This often happens with my students. I record all my lectures and into 10 minutes I realise I haven't turned the damn thing on. So we're beginning today with a slightly different tack, looking at one of his early poems, and then I'm going to take you on a tour through Rilke's relationship with Rodin. Because as I was saying, that relationship shows us so much about what was distinctive about Rilke's way of looking at the world, and how that's really what we're trying to get to the heart of. It's certainly what I'm trying to get to the heart of. What is distinctive about Rilke's way of perceiving the world? Why did it matter to him that we had to have a certain intensity of seeing, a certain intensity of self-forgetfulness? To what extent is this very similar to, you know, the spiritual path of Christian monasticism, and to what extent is it radically different? These are the sorts of questions I've got in my mind. And reading through the Nine Theology again, both in German and in English, and I had the luxury of reading it several times with my mother in German over the weekend, and we went through it, and she has difficulties with it, and she had even more difficulties with the English version, but it was an interesting journey. And, you know, things do become clear as one works with the text. One begins to understand. But the context is important to see where Rilke was coming from. So this first poem here from around about 1900, from one of his early books, in English it's "I'm living my life in spiraling gyres." And the English translation, it's in your workbook here on page 5. Page 5 in your workbook.
It's a gyre.
A gyre is a spiral like you see on the screen there. A spiral, increasing spiral. W.B. Yeats, in his famous poem, The Second Coming, talked about the gyres. Centre cannot hold. Can you remember it?
Yes.
Tell us, please.
I can't remember
it. You can't remember it.
I'm trying.
Things fall apart. The centre cannot hold.
Mere anarchy
is loosed upon the world. Yeah. Maybe Wally can help. Maybe he's just come in. He's just got to get himself organised. But does W.B. Yeats in The Second Coming use the word? He uses,
yes, he does.
Gyres.
He uses gyres.
Yes.
What's the other word he said?
Gyres.
Gyres. Yes.
Can you remember the line?
No.
No.
I can tell you what train I was on this morning. Right?
Okay. All right. Well, there's gyres is not in that yet. No, not yet. It's in the next few lines. Anyway, that's what a gyre is. Are you any clearer, Margaret, now? A little bit clearer. John? Microphone.
I just want to ask this before you forget. Just at the start, those two things that were so important to Rilke, you mentioned self-forgetfulness, and you said before that,
seeing into the depths of things and forgetfulness of self. The intensity of seeing.
The business of intensity of seeing seems to be central to this Nine Theology.
But very much so, that's right. And look, I forgot to ask at the beginning, I've got it at the top of my list, but I didn't read it out. Does anybody have anything that they wanted us to look at for today? Did anybody bring a piece of writing or anything at all? You did. Okay, well, at morning tea, give it to Mari and she'll photocopy it. You didn't? Okay. Well, you can share it then. Would you like to share it at some point? Okay. Doesn't have to be. It can be anonymous. We can, you know, give it to Mari anonymously and we'll read it.
Oh, close my eyes to
So, this early poem. I'm living my life in spiraling gyres that move o'er the choirs nearby. It's on page 5 in your handout. I may never reach the top of the spires, but still my resolve is to try. I circle round God, the ancient expanse for thousands of years, pray to tell, and still I don't know. What shall I be thence? A falcon, a storm, a chorale? In the German, ich lebe mein Leben in wachsenden Ringen. I live my life in ever-growing larger circles, die sich über die Dinge ziehen, which stretch themselves over all things. Ich werde den letzten vielleicht nicht vollbringen. Maybe I'm not going to be able to manage the very last one. Aber versuchen will ich ihn, but I wish to try. Ich kreise Gott, den uralten Turm. I circle around God, that ancient tower. Und ich kreise Jahrtausend lang, and I circle around for thousands of years. Und ich weiß noch nicht, and I still don't know, bin ich ein Falke, ein Sturm oder ein großer Gesang? Am I a falcon, a storm, or a great song? And you know, when you come to his Orpheus poems at the end and the elegies, well, you know, that is his ambition, is to be a great song, ein großer Gesang. This is one of the first poems of Rilke's that really touched something in me. It really was like a trigger, this search, this image of circling around in ever-increasing circles, and this wish to kind of embrace the world through song, and this wish to embrace all things, Dinge, which becomes such a kind of a central word in his later vocabulary. And this poem came to my mind in terms of the seminar that we have here, because I don't think we can go bang onto the Duino elegies. We have to kind of circle around them and come back and come back. My plan, it's kind of shaped itself in my mind. I want today to spend, you know, a little bit of time on the Rodin poems and on Rodin now, because it gives us such a good insight into how he was seeing the world. And then I want to today go back to one of the Orpheus poems, which is particularly central to the Ninth Elegy, then spend some more time on the Ninth Elegy in a more intensive mode. And then next week and the week after, to move back again into some earlier work and move forward to the first elegy, which some of us have done, about 3 of us have done, but it's certainly worth revisiting because it's the foundation for all the elegies. So that's the plan for the next 3 weeks. So you've got a handout I put on your chair, Rilke on Rodin. And Rilke was a very young man. He'd already met Lou Andreas Salome. He'd been to Russia. He'd been to Italy. But he was desperate for looking for a job in Paris. And he couldn't find work to begin with. But eventually he found work where he'd been wanting to go as a secretary to Rodin. And Rodin was living in that house in the top left-hand corner in Meudon. And Rilke approached that house with great trepidation. The description on the front of the handout you've got there just describes what he saw when he went in there. Rilke, on first glimpse of a glass case filled with pieces from the gates of hell. That's a huge sculpture feature that Rodin had been creating. There it lies, yard upon yard, only fragments, one beside the other. Figures the size of my hand and larger, but only pieces. Each of these bits is of such an eminent, striking unity, so possible by itself, so not at all needing completion, that one forgets they are only parts. And Rilke said to Rodin, it was not only to do a study that I came to be with you, it was to ask you, how must one live? Rilke was particularly taken with the intensity of Rodin's work, clarity and purpose of his artistry. And Rilke wrote in a letter to his wife Clara shortly after he'd arrived, I'm sorry about these typos in here, they're just appearing to me. Rodin has a tiny plaster cast, a tiger in his studio, and from this little plaster cast, sorry, I'm rushing too fast here for a moment. This is the inside of the studio in Meudon, and there's Rilke in the there's Rodin in the bottom right-hand corner, in winter uniform for Europe, and there's Rilke and Rodin's wife in the bottom left. That's actually part of one photograph, and there are some of the fragmentary pieces of sculpture that met Rilke's eyes on his first visit. So here are some of the images that struck Rilke. Rodin's sculptures with often fractured surfaces ushered in a new era of sculpture. Elements of impressionism left the monument-like pose of academic style. Mental constitutions could be alive in the moving surfaces. And Rodin speaks of the boldness of light, the modesty of the shadow. Sculpture is the art to represent the forms in the play of light and shadow. Rilke said to his wife, Rodin has a tiny plaster cast, a tiger in his studio. That's not a tiger, that's a lion. And from this little plaster cast, I saw what he means, what antiquity is, and what links him to it. There in this animal is the same lively feeling in the modelling. This little thing, it is no higher than my hand is wide and no longer than my hand, has hundreds of thousands of sides like a very big object. Hundreds of thousands of sides which are all alive, animated, different, and that in plaster. And with this, the expression of the prowling stride is intensified to the highest degree. The powerful planting of the broad paws at the same time, that caution in which all strength is wrapped, that noiselessness. And I think this, what he's saying about this plaster cast applies to all of Rodin's, is this focus on the intensity of the various sides, the shapes, the shadows, the light, all these things kind of illuminating the inner life of the object that's being created. Now, Rilke stayed with Rodin for a few years until he got kicked out by looking into some of Rodin's private business. Rodin didn't like this, there's a story about that. But Rilke wrote two amazing essays about Rodin, one in 1902 and the other one in 1907, and they're a real key to Rilke's aesthetics. And what you've got on this sheet here is just a few extracts from my reading of these essays. So, for example, here is Rodin's Man with the Broken Nose. And Rilke wrote, its beauty is not solely a result of the incomparable meticulousness with which it was crafted. It comes rather from the sense of proportion, the balance of the living planes, and from an understanding of the fact that all these moments of ferment come to rest within the thing itself. And then about Victor Hugo, Rodin did produce this statue of the French novelist Victor Hugo. Never before has the human body been so concentrated around its interior, so shaped by its own soul, and yet restrained by the elastic power of its blood. And the way the neck rises ever so slightly, stretching to hold the listening head above the distant rush of life, is so impressive and deeply felt that one has a difficult time remembering a gesture as moving or expressive. The arms are noticeably missing. Anyone like to make a comment or thought about what's been said so far in terms of Rilke's response to Rodin? Yes, Carol.
I just get the idea that Rodin might be annoyed with all these words. A man who puts all of his energy into making something with his hands,
yeah,
and somebody's there chatting all the time about how great he is.
Yes. Interesting. Well, the truth is actually that Rodin was very pleased with the essays that Rilke wrote about him eventually. Because Rilke, when Rilke joined Rodin, Rilke didn't have a name yet. But by the time he'd finished working with Rodin, he had quite a big name around Europe. and his essays really kind of helped to kind of explode Rodin's fame even further. But yeah, it's an interesting comment. Yes, please, Catherine.
What fascinated me, reading some over the week, but also now, you're stressing the fact that Wilke always looked to the interior of the thing.
Yes, that's exactly it.
I find it hard looking at it to get beyond the external
surface
of what he saw.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if Rodin was a bit surprised at this interior stress.
That's a lovely comment, because it's going to take us right to Rilke's poem about one of Rodin's statues, in which he kind of takes interiority even further. And I think that, you know, in that sense, the two artists were collaborating, not deliberately, but Rilke was kind of penetrating further into what he saw there. Very, very good. So the next images I've got here relate to this next quotation on the page. The same thing is, this is Rilke still speaking, the same thing is true of Rodin's armless statues. Nothing essential is missing. Standing before them, one has the sense of a profound wholeness, a completeness that allows for no addition. This is still Rilke. The artist's task consists of making one thing of many and a world from the smallest part of a thing. In Rodin's work, there are hands, independent little hands, which are alive without belonging to any single body. There are hands that rise up, irritable and angry, and hands whose five bristling fingers seem to bark like the five false heads of Cerberus. There are hands that walk, hands that sleep, and hands that wake, criminal hands weighted with the past, and hands that are tired and want nothing more. But then, hands are a complicated organism, a delta in which life from the most distant sources flows together, surging into the current of action. Hands have stories. They even have their own culture and their own particular beauty. There we have it. Now, with reference, there's more to be read here, but I'm just going to take a break and look across into your booklet to page 16. Now this is moving along from Catherine's comment. It's an appropriate time to go there. And we'll come back to some of these Rodin comments. The way that what it is that Rilke sees about seeing with intensity, seeing into the depths of something. And it was Rodin who told Rilke to go out into the city to look at people on the streets, to go especially to the zoo, Jardin des Plantes, where he saw the panther. We're going to talk about that a bit more this morning. But also to look at, well, Rilke took the liberty to look at Rodin's sculptures and to see what was there. And in this particular sculpture, the archaic torso of Apollo. Well, let's have a look at the English version first, over the page on page 17. We cannot know his incredible head, because his head's obviously not there, where the eyes ripened like apples. Yet his torso still glows like a candelabrum, from which his gaze, however dimmed, the gaze of Apollo, the gaze were in the eyes, in the head that's not there, from which his gaze, however dimmed, still persists and gleams. If this were not so, the bow of his breast could not blind you, nor could a smile, steered by the gentle curve of his loins, glide to the center of procreation. And this stone would seem disfigured and stunted, the shoulders descending into nothing, unable to glisten like a predator's pelt, because the shoulders and the whole statue does seem to glisten with a life. Unable to glisten like a predator's pelt, or burst out from its confines and radiate like a star. For there is no angle from which it cannot see you. this intensity. You have to change your life. Now here's the German. Wir könnten nicht sein, this is on page 16. Wir könnten nicht sein unerhörtes Haupt. We never knew his unheard of head. Darin die Augenäpfel reiften, in which the eye apples ripened. Aber sein Torso glüht noch wie ein Kandelaber. But his body is glowing still like a candelabra. Indem sein Schauen nur zurückgeschraubt sich hält und glänzt. This is beautiful. His torso is glowing like a candelabra, in which his seeing has been screwed down, because the head is gone, the seeing has been screwed down, and there it holds itself and glows. Sonst könnte nicht der Bug der Brust nicht blenden. If this were not so, the bow of the breast couldn't blind you in this way. Und im leisen Drehen der Lenden könnte nicht ein Lächeln gehen zu jener Mitte, die die Zeugung trug. And in the very gentle turning around towards the Lenden, towards his lower part of his body, there could not be that gentle smile towards his middle, which carries the force of procreation. Sonst stünde dieser Stein entstellt und kurz unter der Schultern. If this were not so, this stone would stand deformed and short below the shoulders, below the invisible drop of the shoulders, and it would not glimmer with the fur of a wild animal, and it would not burst out of all its framework, its render, like a star. Denn da ist keine Stelle, die dich nicht sieht, because there is no place where you cannot be seen by this statue. Du musst dein Leben ändern. You must change your life. So there's his intense form of seeing. Mari last week talked about Gerard Manley Hopkins and Hopkins' way of viewing nature and viewing the inner light, the inscape, the of nature. Rilke goes a step further, it seems to me, here. He kind of takes us into the quickening, well, it's his own nature, his quickening energetic vision of the kind of power that he hears in all forms, even in a sculptured form. Anyone like to make a comment or have a thought? Hang on, Mari. Let's start again with a microphone. Sorry.
And immediately you go inwards.
That's right. It takes you beyond the surface.
Yes.
Yeah.
And very quickly.
Yeah. No, it, for me too. I remember in about 1970, an exhibition of Rodin in the David Jones Gallery here in Sydney, and I was walking around these sculptures, and they just had an amazing effect for me. And there's one in the New South Wales Gallery, the Burghers of Calais, at the moment, and I take my students to see that, and every figure there is a figure in a moment of crisis, but such a kind of an inward gaze, such a sense of pondering the whole nature and the purpose of their existence. Beauty and terror. Beauty and terror, yeah.
In the poetry of Rilke, but also in this
artist. In this, yeah, lovely. Let's come back to this sheet here. So we turn the page, and this is from Rodin's essay, Part 2, 1907. My typo's on here, terrible. I thought I'd spell check this. No, I'm not going to beat my students up so much in future. This is Rilke speaking again. And this is Rilke speaking to us, the audience, inducting us into Rodin's work. When I say the word, are you listening? It grows silent. The silence that surrounds things. All motion subsides and becomes contour, and something permanent is formed from the past and the future. Space, the great calm of things, liberated from desire. If possible, I ask you to return with your mature... Now, hang on a second. The context here, I should have made this clear. The context is he's talking about things. Things. Bottom of the previous page, the title is a subsection of this essay called Things. And maybe from last week you got the idea or you got the understanding that for Rilke, things, Dinge, are an absolutely critical philosophical aesthetic item in his vocabulary. He talked about Dinggedichte, Ding, poems about things. And in the Ninth Elegy he talks about things. And here he's, in a sense, trying to open up for us a memory of childhood when things were more important. We've lost that sense of connection with things now. When I say the word, are you listening? It grows silent. Things. The silence that surrounds things. All motion subsides and becomes contour, and something permanent is formed from the past and the future. Space. The great calm of things liberated from desire. If possible, I ask you to return with your mature, refined sensibility to one of the things that was most familiar to you as a child. Try to remember if there was anything in the world that was closer, more familiar, and more necessary than this thing. Was it not the case that everything else in the world could cause you pain or treat you badly? If kindness, trust, and the sense of not being alone could be counted among your earliest experiences, do you not owe it to that thing? How can things become so important? How are things related to us at all? What is their story? At this point, I've changed the screen now, you might want to look up here. This is a picture of John the Baptist walking on the left. Then the next picture along is Rodin's picture of Orpheus rescuing Eurydice from hell. The next picture is one of the burghers in Calais who's holding the keys. The next picture is a young man reaching up to the heavens. And the bottom picture is the thinker. At this point, I dare to mention the name that cannot be withheld any longer, Rodin. As you know, this is the name of countless things. You ask to see them, and I am confused because I cannot show you a single one. But I almost feel as if I could see some of them in your memory, as if I could lift them out and place them before us. That man with the broken nose, unforgettable as a sudden raised fist. The young man who stretches up in motion on the right, as familiar as your own awakening. That walker on the left, upright like a new word for waking in the vocabulary of your feeling. And the one who sits, thinking with his whole body, withdrawing into himself. And the burger with the key, like a great repository of pure pain. And some small things whose name you have forgotten, made from a shimmering white embrace that holds together like a knot. And still smaller ones you find within yourself, like fruits with very thin skin. And now that these have been called from your memory, shall I draw on others from these hundreds of things? On Orpheus, Saint Teresa receiving her wound, Victor Hugo with his commanding gesture. And I can already feel how the name falls apart in my mouth, how it is all simply the poet, the same poet who is called Orpheus, when his arm extends beyond all things to the strings, strings of the lyre, the same one who clings in pain and anguish to the feet of the muse as she escapes, and who dies in the end, his face upright in the shadow of the voices that fill the world with song. A death so impressive that this small group is often called resurrection. And then in his conclusion to his essay on Rodin, he writes, "I feel more strongly than ever before that with these things, sculpture has grown to a prodigiousness that can only be compared to antiquity. And this sculpture has been born in an age that has no things or houses or external objects. For the inner life that makes up this age is formless and intangible. It is, in short, in flux." 1900. 1907. "It was left to this man, Rodin, to grasp it. In his heart, he was one who gave form to it like a god. For transformation, too, has its god. It was as if he had taken molten metal and let it harden in his hands. This was his work. He raised his world above us in an immense arc and made it part of nature." Anyone like to have a thought or a comment before we move on to the panther? Carol, microphone.
Places and all these people in that short lifetime of his, you know, but how he could read so much into life, you know. He has lots of words here, but I imagine he's mostly silent in order to be able to find these words, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm just feeling, whoop.
Yeah. Yes, Mari?
Very, very simple, but I just think he's got a terrific appreciation of Rodin's capacity to recover the depths of life, in a sense.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. He does. He has a real appreciation of Rodin's capacity to recover something from what's around and to kind of ignite it with significance and give it its depth.
And in a context that doesn't appreciate the depths.
That's right.
What I think he's saying.
That's right. Yeah, and one of the things that strikes, you know, when I take my students to the New South Wales Gallery and you know, wax lyrical and rhapsodic about the maquette they've got there about Rodin's burgers, the Rodin sculpture, at the end of the corridor is a typical Victorian statue of a Greek figure wrestling with serpents. I can't remember the name of it now, but it is just so kind of flat. You know, going back to this comment made at the top here, that Rodin's sculpture ushered in a new era of sculpture, left the monument-like pose of academic style. It left that. It was inward. It was influenced by impressionism, by expressionism. I mean, Rodin helped to form this new way of intensive seeing. And this, of course, exactly simultaneous with poetry. Yes.
You just flashed back to a picture of somebody on the right hand side.
Yep.
Was magnificent.
Yes.
The next one. That one.
Yeah. I don't know the name of that, but it's in that book there, and the book does not have titles for any of the images.
It's magnificent.
Yeah. It is.
You can really feel it. Yeah. You're seeing the man. Wonder what his life
has been
like.
That's right.
He sort of takes him into his whole life.
It does. Yeah. Almost like a Rembrandt portrait, something of that order. So we've just come to the panther, which is on page 16. And it struck me that this poem, The Panther, is a kind of beautiful companion poem to the archaic torso of Apollo. Because the archaic torso of Apollo, speaking about a statue that is, you know, intentionally disfigured, it's lost its head, it's lost its arms, it's just a torso. That's what it is, a torso. And yet it's filled with a glowing energy and life. It radiates in such a way that it kind of, for Rilke certainly, demands that we change our life. It has that kind of intensity about it. A transformative influence in that artwork. Cancer is like completely opposite in a way. I wonder whether you share that thought. I read the English first. Page 16. His gaze against the sweeping of the bars has grown so weary it can hold no more. To him there seem to be 1,000 bars, and back behind those 1,000 bars no world. The soft, the supple step and sturdy pace that in the smallest of all circles turns moves like a dance of strength around a core in which a mighty will is standing stunned. Only at times the pupil's curtain slides up soundlessly. An image enters then, goes through the tension stillness of the limbs, and in the heart ceases to be. And here's the German. Bottom of page 15. Sein Blick ist im Vorübergehen der Stäbe so müd geworden, dass nichts mehr hält. His gaze, through having gone so many times over the staves, becomes so tired that his eyes hold nothing anymore, nicht mehr hält. Ihm ist, als ob es 1,000 Stäbe gäbe und hinter 1,000 Stäben keine Welt. It is for him as if there are 1,000 staves, and behind 1,000 staves there is no world. And you know, you get this alliteration and assonance here that you don't get in the English. Als ob es 1,000 Stäbe gäbe und hinter 1,000 Stäben keine Welt. You get the sense of the repetition of sounds reinforcing this idea of an enclosure which is completely sealed. Der weiche Gang geschmiedig starker Schritte, der sich im allerkleinsten Kreise dreht, the soft tread of soft sounding but strong treads, Schritte, der sich im allerkleinsten Kreise dreht, which go around in ever decreasing small circles, ist wie ein Tanz von Kraft eine Mitte, is like a dance of energy around a middle, in der betäubt ein großer Wille steht, in which there is completely silenced a great will, shrunken to nothing. Nur manchmal schiebt der Vorhang der Pupille sich lautlos auf. Only occasionally, the eyelid over the pupil opens itself silently. Dann geht ein Bild hinein, then a picture enters. Geht durch der Glieder angespannte Stille, goes through the whole silent waiting frame of this body, angespannte Stille, und hört im Herzen auf zu sein, and stops dead at the heart. So Rilke's attempt through this close observation of the panther's movement in the cage, trying to enter into the consciousness of this trapped animal, and seeing much more than the animal. I mean, seeing a trapped consciousness. You know, this poem has been talked about a great deal. Thomas Merton got a beautiful lecture on it. An image of a consciousness that cannot find a space beyond its own walls. Very different to the archaic torso of Apollo, with its glowing, glistening force that bursts out of its frame like a star. Interesting comparison. I think both. I think he admires this panther for this amazing energy, this creation. It's a little bit like Blake's the tiger. I don't know if Rilke had read Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright in the Forests of the Night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry. It's a very similar kind of situation, an artist looking at, you know, one of the great creative forces in the world. But here Rilke looking at it caged. Blake is not looking at it caged. I think the pity comes in the caging here. What's your thought, Wally?
Well, the impression occurred to me, just when you were really reading, having brought out a little bit after, I mean, there are positive descriptors in here,
yep,
about the man, the subtle, sturdy,
yep,
mind. And yet on first reading, you get the impression that the idea is to convey how all of this has been rendered null,
yes,
by confinement.
Yes.
But when I did some reading in preparation for the day, there's so much in Rilke's writing about retreating from the world. The band for here is in a perfect state of retreat, and sees the bars.
Yeah.
So the panther almost, in a sense, approximates the ideal of the poet that is to be out of the world. And this mighty will, I mean, in your prose translation there,
yeah,
you have to translate it quite differently. I mean, you refer to the will being reduced, as opposed to this translation, which emphasizes its continuing mightiness.
Well, the words, he uses the word stunned in the translation, and in the German it's betäubt. And betäubt means kind of numbed or deadened.
Right.
It's a question of what connotations you want to draw from that word, yeah.
It can't function, but it still exists.
That's right.
In its previous mightiness.
That's right.
I mean, Rilke is writing around a time when a lot of ideas about the triumph of the will. And
yep, very much so.
Other issues associated with, admiring the heroic.
Yep.
Which comes through in that,
yep,
description of some of Rodin's figures.
Yep.
It feeds into some quite controversial areas.
Yep.
Where aesthetics start to serve in a political and,
yep,
social engineering issues.
Sure.
And that sort of came through a bit more here, but I thought that the poem is sort of pitying the panther, but the more I look at it, the more,
yeah,
I see sort of admiration.
Yes.
Of the
yeah, definitely. I can't disagree with that. Yeah, Rose? Microphone? Microphone? No, you can't shout.
Could the panther be a metaphor for the human being?
Oh, well, I think definitely, yeah. I think inevitably one would see the panther first as something that Rilke has observed in the garden. Actually, the flamingo poem, which we're not going to have time to go to today, someone said, read that, you know, if Rilke had such a respect for animals, why did he go to the zoo to see all these caged animals? And, caged animals are a metaphor for human beings and human consciousness. I don't think one can get away from that. I think that and Rilke is looking for freedom. So, you know, there's an inevitability about seeing the animal as a symbol for the human condition. Yeah. And if it is so, then what? What's the next question? What's the next thought? Are we like that? Are we stunned? Are we stunned like the panther? Well, obviously, in this class here, we're not. We're breaking the boundaries very quickly. Yes, Carol?
I think of the refugee situation that's going on right now.
Yeah.
I think that there is still life. In spite of what's happening.
Not
to,
yeah.
What's happening to these people.
Yeah, that's right.
Hope they have still a spark in them. Instead of being beaten down.
That's right.
Maya Angelou has a book that was titled I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings.
I know it well.
I do too.
Yeah. It's a wonderful book.
I
know why the caged bird sings. That's right. She certainly sang. She was a caged bird. Yeah. That's right. Good. Thank you for making that connection.
can see a contrast between this poem and the one we looked at in the beginning.
Yes.
I'm Living My Life in Spiraling Jars, because he was getting expanding jars.
Yes.
And the panther was getting limiting ones.
That's right. That's right. Good. That's a nice connection to make.
And the panther, of course, we think almost like the cheetah is one of the fastest
animals.
And yet here it is immobilized.
That's right.
That makes another one.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. Okay, let's just have a quick look at letter 6 to the young poets on page 7. Picks up something that Wally's just said. Also picks up his interest in Rodin and things written about the same time that he was working with Rodin. From letter 6, halfway down page 7. The necessary thing is, after all, but this, solitude, great inner solitude, going into oneself and for hours meeting no one. This one must be able to attain. He's talking here to a young poet who's written to him for advice. The young poet was actually a young military student in a military academy where Rilke had also spent time, so Rilke felt particularly in tune with this person who was trying to work out what they were going to do with their life, and he wanted to be a poet, and Rilke had left the military academy now, and this is the advice he was giving him. Think, dear sir, of the world you carry within you, and call this thinking what you will, whether it be remembering your own childhood or yearning toward your own future. Only be attentive to that which rises up in you and set it above everything that you observe about you. What goes on in your innermost being is worthy of your whole love. Only the individual who is solitary is like a thing placed under profound laws. And when he goes out into the morning, that is just beginning, or looks out into the evening, that is full of happening, and if he feels what is going on there, then all status drops from him as from a dead man, though he stands in the midst of sheer life. Try being close to things. They will not desert you. There are the nights, still, and the winds that go through the trees and across many lands. Among things and with the animals, everything is still full of happening in which you may participate, and children are still the way you were as a child. And if it worries and torments you to think of your childhood and of the simplicity and quiet that goes with it, because you cannot believe any more in God, who appears everywhere in it, then ask yourself whether you really have lost God. Is it not rather that you never possessed him? Do you believe that a child can hold him? Him whom men bear only with effort and whose weight compresses the old? Do you believe that anyone who really has him could lose him like a little stone? Or do you not think rather that whoever had him could only be lost by him? But if you know he was not in your childhood and not before, if you suspect that Christ was deluded by his longing and Muhammad betrayed by his pride, and if you are terrified to feel that even now he is not, in this hour when we speak of him, what then justifies you in missing him who never was, like one who has passed away, and in seeking him as though he had been lost? Why do you not think of him as the coming one, imminent from all eternity, the future one, the final fruit of a tree whose leaves we are? What keeps you from projecting his birth into times that are in the process of becoming, and living your life like a painful and beautiful day in the history of a great gestation? For do you not see how everything that happens keeps on being a beginning? And could it not be his beginning, since beginning is in itself always so beautiful? Be patient and without resentment, and think that the least we can do is make his becoming not more difficult for him than the earth makes it for the spring when it wants to come, and be glad and confident. Anyone like to make a comment or an observation about that advice to the young poet? Anything there stir your sense of what's important, or anybody got a criticism of his way of looking at God, or microphone, Wally, please.
Just very quickly. Does Rilke's themes include people?
I think it does.
So much of what he seems to write about is retreating from the distraction of people.
That's true. That he certainly did that in his life. It was a complicated, complex scenario for him. He needed people, but he also needed to get away from people. I think we can all relate to that. I think that's a fairly common human experience, but people were very complex. People were difficult for him to deal with. It's much easier to deal with a sculpture than to deal with a person, perhaps. One could be critical of him for that. You've got an observation you'd like to make, Jared? No? You looked like you had a word about to spring out of your mouth. Wasn't quite there. No. Anybody else like to make an observation? That's right. A bit closer, Carol.
He does like to be with people, but look how much time he gave to that young student.
That's true.
I mean, he really poured himself out to that kid.
Yeah, he did. That's right. Yeah.
It reminds me of one of the insights that Irenaeus had.
Irenaeus. Yeah.
The joy of God's hand for the last.
Yes.
And he says that. The problem with Adam, or sin, was that he was impatient and he tried to grow up too quickly. And now we have to ungrow our growing up,
right,
in a way. And Simon Tuttle puts it this way, I couldn't help but think about it.
Yep.
I was reading something else. He said, the result is that man can now only grow up by properly and painfully dismantling of his false grown-upness by unlearning kind of order we impose on the world outside ourselves and one another to protect from the wildness and freedom of God's world.
Okay.
And that whole appreciation he has of going within to the simplicity of the world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The same with the laurel leaf, you know.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, beautiful, thank you, that's great. So I'd now like to turn to the sonnet number 3 in book 1, which is on page 30. Mari, could you just pass this around as well, please? Thank you. I don't want to move on up the microphone out of my... I'm just passing you around a different translation, the one by Stephen Mitchell as well, because it's just interesting for you to see what a different translation can do. So I don't want you to look at this different translation yet, but we will look at it in a moment. So, looking at the English translation of Book 1, Sonnet number 3 on the bottom of page 30, let's just read that first. A god has the power. Now, he's referring to Orpheus. Orpheus, the god who had this transformative power, could bring wild animals out of their lairs, could make inanimate objects move. Very Christ-like figure, you might say. Just like Christ described in Matthew's Gospel. A god has the power, but tell me, shall a man wring the same from a slender lyre? Is it given that a human being will have the same power as a god, wringing that from a lyre, his musical instrument? His senses are awry. Our human senses are awry. And there stand no temples of Apollo. Here we go. Let's just put this up here. There's the temple for Apollo, by the way. And there stand no temples of Apollo at the crossings of two heart lines. You know, he's talking about our dividedness. In our dividedness, there's no temple standing there. Song, by your example, by Orpheus's example, Orpheus's song, does not concern desire, nor pursuit and attainment of its object. It's a song that is letting go of attachment. Song is, for Orpheus, to be. That's the English translation. Trifling for the god, but when shall we be? And when does he alter the earth and the stars in our being? Questioning about how can the power of the god enter into me? This is not, my lad, a matter of your passions, though your voice, now he's talking to a young man, the speaker is now speaking to a young man. This is not, my lad, a matter of your passions, though your voice throw open your lips. Learn to forget that you sang out. That is fleeting. That is fleeting. True singing is a breath of another kind, a breath that aims nowhere. Pneuma within the god, a zephyr. I don't know what pneuma means. I didn't look it up. Soul, pneuma within the god, a zephyr. Now here's the German first, all right? Here's the German with my potted translation. Ein Gott vermag's, a god can do it. A god has the power, vermag's. Wie aber, sag mir, soll ein Mann ihm folgen durch die schmale Leier? But how, tell me, should a man follow him using a small lyre? Sein Sinn ist zwiespalt. Man's consciousness is divided, split. An der Kreuzung zweier Herzwege steht kein Tempel für Apoll. On the crossroads of two heart streams, there is no temple for Apollo. Gesang, wie du ihn lehrst, ist nicht Begehr, nicht Werbung um ein ähnlich noch Erreichtes. Song, as you Orpheus teach it, is not desire. It's not striving after something that is eventually accomplished. And this line is really important. Gesang ist Dasein. Song is being. Being. Für dein Gott ein leichtes, for God something easy. Wann aber sind wir? But when do we have being? Und wann wendet an unser Sein die Erde und die Sterne? And when will he turn to our being, the earth and the stars? Dies ist nicht, Jüngling, das du liebst, wenn auch die Stimme dann dir Mund dir aufstoßt. It's not, young man, occurs when you are in love, when your mouth is forced open by emotion. Lerne vergessen, learn to forget, dass du aufsangst. Learn to forget that you were singing. Das verrinnt, it's something beyond words. In Wahrheit, singen ist ein anderer Hauch. In truth, singing is another kind of breath. Ein Hauch nichts, a breath around nothing. Ein Wehen im Gott, ein Wind. A blowing or a breeze in God, a wind. Now, let me just a couple of things here. There's just a couple of notes I've got here that, with reference to the crossings of the two heart lines, the sanctuaries that stood at crossroads in classical antiquity were dedicated to sinister deities like Hecate, not to Apollo, the bright god of song. And then Rilke wrote to one of his friends, Princess Marie von Thurn, the lady who gave him the Duino castle to work in. Rilke wrote, "It is not only the hearable in music that is important. Something can be pleasant to hear without being true. What is decisive for me in all the arts is not their outward appearance, not what is called the beautiful, but rather their deepest, most inner origin, the buried reality that calls forth their appearance." And then he writes again to the same person about a gust inside the god, a wind, ein Wehen im Gott, ein Wind, the last phrase. He writes, "All in a few days, it was a nameless storm, a hurricane in the spirit, like that time at Duino. Everything that was fibre and fabric in me cracked." I just have a read of this other translation by Stephen Mitchell on the sheet that I've handed out to you. A God can do it, but will you tell me how a man can enter through the lyre's strings? Our mind is split, and at the shadowed crossing of heart roads, there is no temple for Apollo. Song, as you have taught it, is not desire, not wooing any grace that can be achieved. Song is reality. Simple for a God, but when can we be real? When does he pour the earth, the stars into us? Young man, it is not your loving, even if your mouth was forced wide open by your own voice. Learn to forget that passionate music. It will end. True singing is a different breath, about nothing, a gust inside the God, a wind. Amazing, isn't it? This is Stephen Mitchell. So what is this poem about? That's a nice question to ask a class. What is this poem about? And the students would say, you tell me. I said, I've got no idea. I'm just a facilitator. How is Rilke redefining the nature of song? Or why is he wanting to redefine the nature of song? And Rilke himself, of course, has produced these songs, the sonnets to Orpheus. These are Rilke's songs. Yes, please, Catherine. Or are you just combing your hair? Just scratch it. Oh, it's a very dangerous thing to do. Anyone got a thought at all? How about John over on my left? Very still and reflective this morning. Microphone. What's your first thought about how he's trying to define song, John?
I'm not answering the question.
Yep.
I just, through all of these things, it's amazing.
Bit closer.
Amazing to be with him in the struggle that he has with the intensity with which he deals with these things and behind it all, you know.
Yep.
How can we enter?
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly hitting the chord of what kind of makes these poems, gives these poems their kind of life, their intensity. It's almost like the Rodin statue in a way. It confronts us with a question. It's his question and it becomes our question. What is needed to have being? I mean, we struggle with it every day, do we not? How can I be authentic? How can I shred the layers of my inauthenticity? How can I connect with something that is true, that gives me a real sense of direction, like Orpheus?
And that just, I'm jumping ahead, I suppose.
Yep.
But he says, with all the struggling in the Ninth Elegy, he says, you can't impress him with glories of feeling. He's always in the midst of glories of feeling.
Yeah. That's right.
Everything we read is not in the glories of feeling, but the struggle with
isn't that exactly what he's telling this young man who might be himself? Young man, it's not your loving, even if your mouth was forced wide open by your own voice. Learn to forget that passionate music. And Rilke had a lot to deal with in that department. I don't know how many partners he had. 6, 7, and a lost child. You know, this was a real complexity for him in his life. Yes, please, we're going to Margaret. First Margaret and then Wally.
I was just thinking of the human voice. You know, when you actually go to an opera or something and concert, you hear this amazing voice.
Yes.
And I was just thinking, you know, you can get scientific, very deep about what is sound.
Yeah.
And how deep is sound? It's almost the elemental thing.
Yes.
And I think that's probably something he's looking at there.
Yes.
Like the really essence of sound, of all kinds of sound.
Yes.
Breath and all that, so you get quite scientific about that.
That's right.
But it's, you know, you look at all cultures, and cultures are, you know, expressed. Lots of cultural understandings are expressed in song.
That's right.
And rhythm, and so it's pretty important.
That's right. And you think of the Tibetan monks in their deep earthbound sound that connects them with the Om of the movement of the earth. And there's this wonderful passage in David Malouf's novel Fly Away Peter, where one character comes back from Europe where he studied Beethoven and Mozart and Chopin. He comes back to his parents' veranda in southern Queensland, and he hears the sounds of the frogs, and he realizes that is the ground base of all the music that he's ever studied in Europe. That kind of thing. Beautiful. Should read it. Fly Away Peter, incredible. Wally.
This sonnet that we tried sort of seems to be saying it's the inspiration is all.
Inspiration is all.
And I mean, he actually uses, I don't know whether it's true in German, but in the Latin language, of course, inspiration means breath.
Breath, that's right.
He's in this poem and many of his writings, he seems to be fascinated, or he credits beginnings more than outcomes.
Yeah. Very much so. Beginnings more than outcomes. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
And in his own life, was it how many, six relationships? Or
maybe. Maybe eight.
To new beginnings all the time.
All the time. Yeah. And yet he held on to many of them. There wasn't division there either, so that's really interesting. But what do you make about beginnings, Wally? I didn't quite sort of get the full richness of what you were saying there.
Well, he says that the song, which is the written words and the melody, are ultimately to be cast aside.
Yes.
He urges the notion that it's in the act of taking a creative step that a higher good is attained.
That's right. Or a higher state is attained.
Higher state. Going back to his poem, or his writing, I should say, about the Rodin torso figure, I thought it was a marvellous piece of writing, and in terms of putting in words an individual's response to a work of art.
Yes.
It's sort of an exemplar.
Yeah.
But it's curious in the sense that he makes a very strong case that Rodin didn't have to put the head on the figure.
That's right.
Because everything was implicit in the forms of the body.
That's right. So
the head was there, and what kind of head it might be.
Yeah.
But then he goes on to say that that head can see us wherever we are, an omniscient head. So
yes.
He actually leaps from a literal or regular, everyday response to something which is not necessarily justified in the argument, you know what I mean.
But doesn't he say the head is contained within the shape, the mellifluous shape and the form of the torso itself?
Yeah. But then he also says, wherever you are, the head can see you. Well, in a human being, that's impossible.
Or the torso can see you.
I think he says the head.
Does he?
Yeah. But anyway, he's imputing an omniscience.
He's imputing an omniscience.
That figure,
that's right.
Is a leap into another dimension.
That's right.
But I don't know that he actually argues the case for.
Yeah.
In a particular way.
Yeah, yeah. No, he does. He leaps into a... Well, that's right. The torso becomes a catalytic factor for something that is demanded of a change in himself as he sees it. It has that kind of weight or relevance to it. It's godlike in that sense. It demands a change of being almost. Just like here in the Orpheus, in the reflection on Orpheus, we haven't got a statue of Orpheus in front of us. We've got Rilke's insubstantial image of Orpheus, because it's said that he's really referring to Orpheus dismembered in the universe, but it's Orpheus's song that is alive. And that phrase, Gesang ist Dasein. Well, as you say, you know, the song, the literal external manifestations of the song are almost irrelevant, but song is being. Or being is song. I mean, you know, if we attain to being, if we attain to who and true we true who we truly are we not song? A musician might say, or are we not art? An artist might say. Or yes, Mari. Go, Margaret.
I was going to say
Catherine, sorry.
Yeah, well, last week and this week, the song Henri Bergson keeps coming to me.
Who, sorry?
Henri Bergson.
Oh, Henri Bergson, yeah.
Yeah. And it keeps coming, and I think it's because when I studied him, after a number of others that I found a bit depressing,
yeah,
it was like a song going right through me when I first studied him, yeah, and I conveyed it in teaching, and I made people feel it, and now I feel the same thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of like his idea was that there's a rushing up through the universe.
Yeah.
He called it elan vital,
yeah,
like a vital force.
Yeah.
But he said it rushes right through, and it is reality. And what we call matter is the kickback, like it's a rocket.
Yeah.
The rocket's power is the real thing.
Yeah.
And the stuff coming out the back of the jet.
You're right.
That's matter.
You're right.
That we see.
Yeah.
And we get involved in.
You're right.
It's not the real thing.
Right.
The real thing is that thrust going up.
That's interesting.
And this is so much like that.
Yeah, right. Very interesting. Very interesting. Look, we're going to take a break now because coffee time is going to come when we have to finish unless we stop now. So let's have a break for 7 minutes and then come back and jump into the ninth elegy. 7 minutes, no more, no less.